take your protein pills. The Poisoned Electric Head Story.
The Infinity Fridge of Uden. Continued. I've no idea where we spent the night, but I recall Bill was out of control, and in the end, six of us had to rush him with seat cushions. He'd already playfully attacked Eve, Saucy Jack's friend, and broken her glasses. He laughed at our assault, prepared to swat us aside like insects. But his balance was shot, and when he went down, he sparked out of his own volition. The next morning, we found the venue, a sports arena on the outskirts of town, and tried to organise things in as professional a manner as we could muster. There seemed to be some concern about power sockets and UK plugs, so me and Bun bounded off into the town to try to acquire some adapters. Despite the Dutch well-deserved reputation for the mastery of English, out here in the sticks we encountered few people who spoke it to any competent degree, and our efforts in shops were heavy going. At one point we thought we'd cracked it when a flash of recognition occurred on one guy's face, and he bounded off into the back, but our short-lived hopes dissolved when he returned with matching hand luggage. In the end, we admitted defeat and returned to the arena empty-handed, where we found the whole thing had been a misunderstanding and there wasn't a problem after all. This was typical of our cack-handed, hungover way of dealing with things. You just can't beat wandering round a strange town where you don't understand a word or have a clue where you're going, when your head is about to split open and you're sweating, clammy, dehydrated and confused. It's character building. I'm referring to myself, of course. Bun was as clear-headed and button-bright as ever. In the arena, the backstage area consisted of two large facing changing rooms, and each contained showers, benches, clothes hangers and a fridge full of beer, which, unless the Dutch concept of keep fit is as liberal as their drug policy, was there just for the day. They were organised so that each artist could occupy a dressing room for an hour before their onstage appearance, and 90 minutes afterwards to unwind and party a little. So at the appointed time we set up camp, cracked a few bottles and prepared to go on. The gig itself was a blast, and the organisation second to none. Both Bill and I were set up on risers in the wings, which were wheeled effortlessly into position during the seamless changeover. The stage itself was enormous, typical of the kind you see on any televised festival footage. Or it seemed to be when you were used to having to duck to avoid the neck of a guitar most nights. There would be no such problems here, as from my lofty perch the guitarist appeared like tiny axe-wielding insects in the distance. I spy with my little eye something beginning with C. I spy with my little eye a cockroach with a Gibson SG. Down at the front, Al was experiencing similar dimensional vastness, as he battled to follow the Dutch operational instructions of a desk the length of a bus. But he pulled it off with aplomb, and the show was a beauty. And here's a track from that festival, The Planet Pull, in Uden in 1994. The tape runs out just at the end, and we just missed the final crescendo of the song, but that's the way it was back then. It was on a cassette. We're lucky to have it. This is What You're Gonna Be, Son.
Is there any English people in the audience today? Not the ones we brought with us. Wait, is that all? Can anyone speak the language? I'm sorry, we're a bit ignorant ourselves. We don't go in for that learning stuff, whatever that is. Anyway, that reminds me of when I was a kid. My dad said to me,
"What you gonna be, son?"
Many times, so many times, so many times.
in the dressing room afterwards, we waded into the fridge, which, despite our best efforts earlier, seemed to be full again. So with a steely resolve, we ploughed all our efforts into emptying it again within our allotted time. This wasn't as easy as it appeared on the surface, for this was a fridge unlike one we'd ever encountered. Like birthday cake candles that refused to be blown out, it regenerated itself. Like the everlasting Guinness bottle the genie bequeathed on the Irishman, it could never be quaffed. What all this in reality amounted to was that every half an hour or so, a cute Dutch girl would come in and check on its status. She would say something along the lines of, "Tut tut, you naughty Englishmen," in an accent that bordered on the erotic, wag her finger at us in mock disapproval, then restock it. When the time came to vacate, we were understandably loath to leave this wondrous object behind. So we chose to bury our heads in the sand and ignore the fact. It was a hopeless gesture, akin to hiding under the bedclothes when the alarm clock rings. But we hung on, trying to stretch out those precious minutes until we got the heave-ho. Except it never came. From the outside, the scenario evidently appeared to be a different one. There were a dozen of us, all English, and all drinking like there was no tomorrow, and showing no intentions of leaving. So our ever-pragmatic Dutch hosts took a different tack. Rather than kick us out, which is what we deserved and would have responded to, a lifetime of Pavlovian training with the last orders bell at the hands of sourpuss landlords had seen to that. They chose to seal off the area and adopt a one dressing room system for the remainder of the event. This in effect meant that all the following bands and headliners had to share for the rest of the night. Outrageous. On top of that, they chose to continue filling the fridge at the same rate, thus sealing their fates. And after that, it all gets a bit blurred. To my mind, the only people who entered the room from that point on were the fridge girl and a journalist from a local radio station who conducted an interview. He commenced with an innocuous enough question, something like, "How's everybody feeling?" which was followed by a long silence, suddenly ruptured by everybody pissing themselves laughing, the sound of which was exaggerated and amplified by the tiled surroundings. The only reason I can recall this is he saw fit to send us a copy a few weeks later. What went on from there was a succession of moronic replies that on tape seemed accompanied by a laugh track, and God knows what a listening audience made of it that evening. From time to time, we wandered out into the arena to watch the bands, particularly Porcupine Tree, whose career we'd been semi-following since we both appeared on the Delirium album, Psychedelic Sauna, and no one saw fit to upbraid us for our unacceptable behaviour. After the concert, we were directed to a motel, where we commandeered the bar area with the Porcupines, before retiring to the luxurious rooms. Suffice to say, we were never invited back, and if there was any comeback to Brian Helene, he didn't let on. But maybe he was wondering what kind of white elephant he'd inadvertently bought a piece of in the crusty signing frenzy. Chapter 36, Brown Brogues in Cleethorpes. The demise of the dead fly should have meant a big leap in recording costs. And I suppose we should have accepted the fact and found a record company to foot the bill. But instead, we found a record company that was loath to spend a bean and recorded the second album in Bun's Kitchen. The way we figured it was that record deals were just another form of debt, so we did it ourselves, albeit in far from ideal conditions. Anyone reading the album sleeve may surmise that The Kitchen is a trendy studio name, but it was merely what it claimed to be, and a small one at that. At one end it had a cooker, sink and fridge, and at the other a 24-channel desk, effects rack and wall-mounted monitors. There was no possibility of recording a drum kit, so the rhythm tracks all had to be computerised, and vocals were done in the cupboard under the stairs. Meanwhile, Brian Helene set up a record deal with Abstract Sounds, who agreed to put the album out, release a single, and promote the two via national press coverage and a promo video. We in turn would promote it with our own small-scale 20-date headlining tour. It seemed about time,
after being at it for 8 years. The fly associations were strangely appropriate, though, as that's how we were starting to feel. Doing all the right things, but not moving forward, as if we were pushing against some invisible barrier, like a fly frantically headbutting a window pane. Though with this new team on board, it finally looked as if all that might change. The tour took in all the usual places, what's known as the circuit, a collection of medium venues that, despite their modest size, you won't get a sniff of unless packing some record company clout. And one date effortlessly blurred into the next. Certain dates remain memorable, as we'd managed to generate little pockets of support in those areas, usually oriented around one central character. In Peterborough, it was Steve Woolymaster, an active musician and promoter by night, and ladies' fashion store proprietor by day. Dry and sarcastic don't begin to describe his deadpan demeanour, but suffice to say, it was ideally suited to Torquay Hotel management, and we warmed to him immediately. In Plymouth, it was Toby, a guy with a beautiful attitude and possessing Sid Barrett, My Goldfield good looks, a girlfriend to match. Whenever we played the Cooperage, a great little club, he happily indulged us staying at his flat for a wild party afterwards. Nottingham had become home to ex-Subversion bassist Bone, not the Radio Mongolia one. So any dates there exuded good time teenage reminiscences, and anywhere in Saucy Jack's Manor was guaranteed mayhem and laughs. As for the other dates, we made our friends as we went along, though it was hard to remain civil when a certain Manchester promoter, who shall remain nameless, insisted on using our dressing room to showcase the contents of his attaché case to prospective buyers, the contents being several pillowcase-sized plastic sacks of white powder. I don't ever want to be in the same room as that much street value again. The tour was a repeating cycle of pisswink lager and imaginative interpretations of the phrase food provided. But at least we were touring in our own right as headliners, and there were some great shows. In the middle of it all, the single Out of Order was released, with the full-page ad destined for the NME, finding its way instead into the cheaper and by then all but ignored Melody Maker, where it slipped through the publicity net unseen. A wasted opportunity from a company playing it by the letter. Reviews of the single were non-existent, but we should have known the project was cursed upon receiving the finished artwork. What had started life as one of Phil's biomechanical rusty bronze images came back as a dark brown, incomprehensible slab. How more black could it be? None more black. The limited edition clear vinyl 7-inch bore more promise, but the advertised poster sleeve turned out to be just a piece of paper folded over and reeked of cheap scam. Had fate been on our side, the single would have crept into the top 10 on a week the chart show was featuring the indie charts. As it was, it reached number 11, and just for good measure, they featured the dance top 10 that week instead. We were plugging it the only way we could, playing it at every gig and announcing its release. But it seemed that everyone else involved in its promotion was asleep at the wheel. No airplay, no video exposure, a mainly live performance affair, intercut with scenes of Southport Beach and dancing boiled eggs, lifted beyond mediocrity only by fruit salad's incredible lights, and a sleeve that made Smell the Glove look like Nevermind the Bollocks, all conspired to quickly sink it without trace. Still, there was always the album. Somewhere between Southampton and the M62, I turned 30, and I remember putting in one of those magical performances, the ones that are not only mistake-free, but are somehow energised to a level where you can do no wrong, exuding a controlled static calm from the centre of the cyclone. An exquisite out-of-the-body zen autopilot experience, where you watch your hands perform sublime gymnastics from a detached vantage point of Satori, somewhere above the lighting rig. Once you know such a fleeting place exists, you're in real danger of spending the rest of your life trying to get back there. The following night's concert in Bradford was my actual birthday, so some of the girlfriends were coming along for the show. We arrived sometime early afternoon, Bill and AF disappearing almost immediately, obviously plotting something. When they returned, they looked pleased with themselves and I knew I couldn't expect to get through the day unscathed. They were of the eyebrow-shaving school of practical jokes. As much pain, embarrassment and humiliation as you could get away with, short of a trip to casualty or juvenile court. Indelible ink, super glue and vapour rub had all featured in their past misdemeanours, so I was expecting an attack. But I survived right up to the start of the gig. I could only surmise that whatever was in the wind was probably after the show. I was wrong. Three songs in. It's always three songs in with us, isn't it? A halt was called to proceedings, and I was dragged from behind my synths to the front of the stage. Whereupon, a whip-wielding French maid appeared from the wings. Before long, I was stripped down to my boxer shorts and blindfolded, though I felt most naked and exposed about having my mask removed. Plus, if the girl was going to strip off, why was I the only person not allowed to see it? It was my birthday, after all. I was gently pushed to my knees, and I can only surmise what was supposed to happen next, because things, as ever, in our little world, flew off in an unplanned trajectory. There were cries and commotion from the crowd. My girlfriend Jo's voice saying something about tits and some scuffling, evidently taking place right before me. I hastily removed the blindfold to find the girl naked and Jo and Julie, Phil's wife, not far behind. Three pairs of breasts at close quarters from a kneeling vantage point was more like a birthday treat, and had it not been for the screams and general chaos, I would have savoured the scene a while longer. But the Strippogram's assistant was desperate to extricate the both of them from the volatile scene. Within seconds, he had positioned the girl in my arms, taken a Polaroid, and stuck a bottle of cheap sparkling in my hand, before the pair of them scarpered out of the nearest fire exit. It took a few minutes for the dust to settle and a semblance of normality to return. I still wasn't sure quite what had taken place, but we had to somehow regain composure and complete the rest of the gig. It was impossible. The damage had been done and the crowd hated us, particularly a gang of aggressive women at the back who jeered and booed for the remainder of the performance. We finally limped to the end of the ordeal, wisely skipping an encore, and I went to find out what the hell that other performance had been all about. Jo was furious with me.
You were loving it. You would have let her if I hadn't stopped her and she was about to, and you would have joined in.
The details were still sketchy, but I began piecing the facts together that after losing her knickers, the girl needed somewhere to sit, and in the absence of chairs, there was always Bri's face, right? Well, what would you have done? It's a question I'm still asking myself, and the phrase, take the weight off your feet, love, you've had a long day, keeps coming to mind. What the hell? I was 30, and on such milestone occasions, you find yourself thinking that the time to shy away from life in all its lurid forms has passed. But no, I'd done the wrong thing, or somehow indicated that I would have done the wrong thing, if wrong things had been allowed to run their depraved course. It was all very confusing, as if you want tits, I'll show you tits, was seen as quite a respectable course of action. It certainly got Julie's vote, whereas I was the guilty party just for being AF's and Bill's fall guy. This thought led me to the source for more explanation, and the pair of them filled in the blanks. It transpired that upon finding a kissogram agency and discussing the price, the owner had asked how far they wanted to go. They, of course, had replied, all the way, and then some, prompting the guy to maybe cross some legal borders for a quick earner, and those two to blitz a sizeable chunk of the band funds. Still, they did it for me, bless them. Guys, I'm sorry you didn't get your money's worth. Believe me, you don't know how sorry I am. Some weeks later, our agent received a nasty letter from the club in question concerning our tactless and sexist behaviour and how much it had upset the anarcho-feminist regulars. Whoops. Yet more proof of the counterculture encumbering itself with more rules of etiquette than the mainstream. Did we care? Not really. Someone famously said, fuck 'em if they can't take a joke. And that summed up our attitude. We were on tour, maybe a dozen dates in, so we'd torn up the rule book and used it for toilet paper weeks ago. You know things have reached stupidity levels when the simple act of urinating has become an adventure sport. People were hanging out of the bus doors with a chirpy nonchalance as we hurtled along into the night, approaching the task with ever more casualness as the drunkenness climbed. I remember on one occasion swinging out into the blackness, an inebriated Scottish passenger I'd never met before, hanging on precariously to my shirt collar. "Don't ye worry, laddie, I'll not let ye fall," he cheerfully sang as the motorway lights flashed by. And I pondered that if he did happen to let go, would he even bother telling the others? After all, on one occasion, Bill had actually pushed AF out of the side door at high speed. This playful prank only narrowly avoided becoming death by misadventure, thanks to Phil's lightning reactions, who managed to pull him back in at the last second. I swear AF's head was millimetres from the whizzing tarmac. A chaotic zigzagging up and down the country that followed no discernible logic. Birmingham, Norwich, London, Newcastle, Manchester. It would have made a good theme for a pinball machine, us bouncing around from north to south and back again, before grinding to a halt in the seaside town of Cleethorpes on the eve of a bank holiday. We arrived late in the evening and found a calm and tranquil parking spot on the seafront, little expecting the transformation the morning would bring. Few things on this earthly plane truly resemble Dante's seven circles of hell, but Cleethorpes seafront on a bank holiday is one of them. We awoke to find ourselves the centrepiece in a Hieronymus Bosch triptych, a scene populated by screaming kids, traffic wardens and ice cream wielding day trippers of indeterminate gender, possibly a third one we didn't know about. Or maybe it was the hangover. Have you ever noticed that really weird people always stare at you like you're the circus exhibit? Billy couldn't step off the bus without a crowd gathering. Saucy Jack, on the other hand, was in his element, being a cockney sparrow raised on seaside capers and bounded off in search of jellied eels. Well, green Rizzlers, probably. As for Phil, he was never at his best first thing. None of us ever were. Usually as a result of the night before. On this occasion, it had been a night off, and we'd spent it discussing bungee jumping. Or more precisely, would you or wouldn't you? It was a question made all the more poignant by the fact that the Cleethorpes promoter had said there would be a bungee tower in the venue car park. And we were all on for a free go. As you may surmise, the bravado levels were fairly high in certain quarters, a pissed-up session being a fertile ground for bold claims. But the wise amongst us chose to stay non-committal on the subject, knowing it would be a different story the next day. The source of Phil's tetchy demeanour that fine morning was as old as time itself, man's primeval quest for the lavvy. Someone pointed him in the direction of some public toilets down the seafront, and he trundled off, peppering the air with expletives as he went. A relatively peaceful half hour ensued, as people pottered around for clean socks and nourishment. But the silence was shattered when the bus door slid violently open, and Phil burst in and shouted, "Where's the fucking hammer?" Something had evidently upset him. So someone said, "Chill out, bald guy, what's the beef?" I'd like to think. And he regaled his woes. It transpired that he'd found the toilets easily enough and settled into a cubicle, idly noticing the ubiquitous hole in the adjoining wall that was sealed up with toilet roll and sellotape. Someone took up residence in the cubicle next door, and all was fine until the rustling sound began. His neighbour was gently prodding the paper membrane with his finger. Surely some sort of tissue-tapping Morse code. The mating call of the lesser-spotted toilet dweller. It was that nasty abrasive paper, favoured by correctional institutions, and Phil watched in muted horror and fascination, until it tore and a finger burst through. That broke the silence, and he bent down to get a glimpse of this bold would-be suitor, simultaneously bellowing, "What the fuck's going on, you fucking prodding bastard?" The perpetrator bolted in terror, and Phil just managed to glimpse a pair of brown brogues making a sharp exit, before he pulled up his strides and attempted to give chase. But it was too late, the culprit had gone. So now he was in search of a weapon and a brown shoe-wearing victim. We pointed out the folly of wandering the streets of a busy seaside town, hitting random strangers with a hammer, solely based on their choice of footwear, but he wouldn't be swayed. In the end, our only recourse was to refuse to hand it over. Saucy Jack had returned in the middle of all this, and upon hearing the tale, mischievously bounded off again, leaving the rest of us to enjoy Phil's volcanic rage, which eventually receded to a simmering discontent. Saucy went back to a flea market he'd spotted earlier and picked up the perfect gift for Phil, which he proudly presented to him an hour later.
"Phil, mate, look what I've got you,"
he beamed.
"A pair of brown brogues, and I've stuffed them with toilet paper."
The day rolled on, and the time eventually arrived for us to locate the venue, a disco-type club further up the seafront, easily identified by a bungee tower in the car park. Up close, the thing looked medieval and insane, all the more tortuous for sending its victims plummeting towards hard concrete. Yet logically, it presented no danger. Logically. The thing is, at last count, we didn't have any Vulcans amongst us. Although P had developed a disturbing habit of speaking like a smash Martian cum Dalek, and which was beginning to spread to the rest of us. I recall a shared dressing room one time, with all of us talking in that manner, annoying the fuck out of the other bands. Eventually one guy snapped, and irately said,
"For fuck's sake, why don't you pack in that stupid fucking voice?"
There was a pained silence before P replied in his best robo-talk, and sadly, in all honesty,
"We are unable to."
We loaded the gear into the club, studiously ignoring the bungee activity in the hope that it would go away and the matter wouldn't be raised. But before long it was. Now it was the turn of the lily-livered to bask in the non-committal of the night before and watch the others squirm. The ways they tried to wriggle out of it constituted an object lesson in human nature at its slipperiest, such as you might witness in a war atrocities trial or any aspect of American politics. Some went for denial, others a complete U-turn, and to hell with any loss of face. And there was one desperate and imaginative soliloquy concerning endorphin depletion. The argument went that if you were in any subsequent real-life trauma situation, like losing an arm in an industrial machine's whirring cogs, then you would feel utter, unadulterated pain because you'd spunked all your body's natural painkillers away on frivolous thrill-seeking activities, such as the one before us. To be fair to the guy, you couldn't blame him trying to save face, because unlike so many other people, he only had the one. Anyway, we all breathed a huge collective sigh of relief when daylight crept away and took the infernal contraption with it. As for the gig, I remembered little of it, which is a shame as it was the final date on what would turn out to be our final UK tour.
Chapter 37, Electric Shadyland.
After the less than earth-shattering The Big I Am tour to promote the album of the same name, which to illustrate Zappa's conceptual continuity was taken from a Vivian Stanshall quote, we took stock of our situation. We had a manager who seemed to like us, as people at any rate, though he seemed to be waiting for us to pay out in silver dollars so he could recoup his investment. I think we were his side bet, an outsider that might pay off. But in the meantime, his managerial efforts, we suspected, were going into other outfits with better odds. We had an agent who seemed to neither like nor dislike us, though with Nigel Morton it was hard to tell, as he limited his communication with us to the minimum of words, syllables whenever possible. And thirdly, we had a record company that seemed to actively despise us. The fault for poor sales of the album sat squarely at our feet and had nothing to do with their lackadaisical promotion of it. It had in fact sold quite well in the first few weeks of release, but they were reluctant to invest in a repressing, resulting in a breakdown of distribution. And we started to get letters from fans who couldn't find it or order it even. After constant badgering from us, Abstract Sounds begrudgingly agreed to do another run, and that's when things really began to go pear-shaped. We'd requested a few boxes ourselves, which we were selling at gigs, having lost faith in the conventional distribution channels. And a few days after one show, we received a call from someone who'd bought the album and wasn't satisfied. The root of his discontent was that though it said Poisoned Electric Head on the disc, it was in fact a live recording of Jimi Hendrix. And much as he was a fan, it wasn't what he'd been hoping for. We could sympathise with that one and promised to replace it immediately, scrambling to check the others after the call ended, And you guessed it, they were all Jimmy. Someone had fucked up royally at the pressing plant, changing the run, but forgetting to change the master. When we informed Edward Abstract of this latest turn of events, he reacted like it was also our fault, before suggesting we send them back, at our expense, of course. At this point, communications became ever fraught, and it became evident that everybody was washing their hands of the Big I Am. The strange parcel it represented was passed frantically from agent to manager to record company and back, and nobody wanted to be left holding it when the music stopped. In the end, we decided to cut our losses and move on. Billy set about negotiating a deal with indie hippie label Voiceprint, and we discussed reverting back to booking gigs and managing ourselves again. The Dutch festival aside, not much had been gained from our more professionally footed alliances. And then, as if to corroborate the fact, something landed in our laps that had nothing to do with Brian or Nigel. And surprise, surprise, everybody wanted a piece of it. Take your protein pills. To be continued.
Poisoned electric head.